truck. Lois, I'd like you to tell me about your background, your family, and growing up where you were born. And tell me about your family.
I was born in Greenville, New Jersey in 1954. My father is, was an aerospace machine. Worked in a plane factory making actuation parts for the actuation plane. Been working in a factory all his life for about 40 years.
What factory?
Curtis Wright Corporation. Mm-hmm.
Where was that located?
Fairfield, New Jersey. It moved around a few times during the war and after the war. So he was graduated from the tech school and was someone who could fix a lot of things.
Oh.
And I remember when I was a kid, I would see him, he'd have a vacuum cleaner was broken, he had it sitting on the table. He'd do some magic on it, and you know, 10 minutes later the thing would work. And I thought he was magic. So, so that was my father. My mother was worked in a factory also most of her life in Westinghouse, and then she stayed home for about maybe 10 years when we were, my sister and I were born, and then she went back to work and worked cleaning people's houses.
Now, was she in the United Electrical Workers or the International Union of Electrical Workers? Do you know?
No, I don't know what union she was. Mm-hmm. My father was in the machinist union.
Okay. And were either of them active in the union?
No, I wouldn't say very active, but they were both very vocal union supporters. Mm-hmm. They always tell me unions are essential to working people's lives, and, you know, mm-hmm. without unions, people would be more, you know, working people's lives. So I grew up with a very strong union. My father still, he's retired, right? He still gets his little union magazine, gives it to me every month, mm-hmm. says, here, Lois.
What about siblings?
I have a sister, Jean, who is a nurse.
And so you went to public school?
Public school.
Mm-hmm.
Greenville High School.
And did you take any shop courses or anything like that?
Nope, we didn't need to sit in the slightest bit.
Okay.
No, I was going to be a lawyer.
Okay, you must be a lawyer.
I took an academic course and went on to college right after high school.
Where did you go to college?
Rutgers College. I was the first class of women at Rutgers.
What year was that?
It was 1972.
Mm-hmm.
There were 500 women and about 7,000 or 8,000 men.
And you went to New Brunswick?
I went to New Brunswick.
And you majored in economics?
Right.
What drew you to the study of business science?
I didn't even know what economics was, you know, when I went to Rutgers. Mm-hmm. No, you don't learn that. I didn't even know what it was. I just said, oh, that sounds interesting. Let me take it. And I ended up getting some fairly radical professors who just happened to be at Rutgers and taught political economy. They didn't teach just plain old economics.
Mm-hmm.
And they taught about power and how power is held and how it's related to wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had some sort of intuitive understanding of that, but when I actually started really studying it, it really fascinated me. So I decided to major in it. After my very first course in economics was on radical economics. So it kind of got me started.
So you studied classical economics as well as like Adam Smith and
sure. All of the time.
Mm-hmm.
I studied, actually I majored in development economics. I sort of had a certificate in Latin American studies and people were developing.
It's very popular.
Yeah.
People were really paying attention to third world countries.
Yes, it was a really big hot issue of the day, development. Also, just as I was leaving school, sort of towards the end, labor, I took some labor economics courses and women in the economy and occupational segregation, sex, and race was also pretty hot topic. So
and
I did some research with that.
Mm-hmm. And did you do some papers that stand out in your mind on research in that area?
I did some papers on women in the economy, and looking at why women made so much less than men, what was going on for women economically. And, you know, again, the big factor that stood out about everything was occupational segregation. Women, you know, combined certain jobs and students and others. So I was really very, very interested in that, and I actually got an offer, several offers, to get my PhD for free in economics. But I really decided that I didn't want to stay in academia. I wanted to do something very practical. I wanted to be an activist. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to make a difference and not just hide out in academia.
Were you active with any women's group on campus, or were you part of any networking, grassroots organizations?
Yes. Let's see. We had a women's consciousness raising group on campus because we were the first class of women.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of problems dealing with that. So women got together in my dorm. And we had a weekly meeting, just a regular sort of grassroots CR group. There was a group called Karasa.
Oh, yeah.
Abortion rights group. And my roommate and I ended up starting a New Brunswick chapter of Karasa. And I did a lot of work around that issue for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm. And that was education.
So
you graduated what year?
I graduated in 77, actually, January of 77. I stayed an extra semester. And I got a grant to teach an economics course, which sort of, a political economics course, to compare all the different economists, from Adam Smith to Devlin and Marx. And we sort of looked at what different economists were saying, what their assumptions were, and their values. Then I actually, my first job out of college, I had sent out resumes to United Way for a community organizer, and this group called Somerset Community Action Program ended up hiring me as a community organizer. And it was mostly black African-American group, and they worked with, supposedly worked with poor people in Somerset County. What it turned out to be was basically a poverty agency. These people siphoned off money. And I saw this happening right before my eyes and started raising questions about it. The director was doing his family's, taking money to take care, build his, fix his family's houses instead of people in the community who had applied for the grants. So it was a real interesting experience, seeing what was going on with that poverty money coming through. And it kind of disillusioned me a little bit, because they were also first it was the Foreign Working People's Party, do you remember that? And they turned into the...
And I won't remember the name, but I know what you're talking about. Right.
The New Alliance Party.
Yeah.
That's who they were. And I didn't know any of this when I went into there. And they tried to force you into their program, which I didn't want to. I did start participating for a while, and then I saw what was going on. It just seemed like a big lie. I saw them lying to our constituency, and I just, they threatened me. They were just very bizarre people, and I got out of there after about 9 months.
So you said that in our first interview, you mentioned a friend named Cindy who was working with labor and told you about Mary Garvin.
Right.
Before you even spoke to her about that, you were thinking about the issue of women getting into non-traditional jobs and thinking of working in some way. How did that
come? Right. I had actually started writing a proposal to get women into non-traditional jobs. I started writing it. Maybe 4 years away through. I started looking I was going to apply to the New Jersey Department of Education, which was doing some work around my area. And then Cindy sent me this thing in the mail saying Mary Gardner was starting a program in New York. And it was exactly what I was doing, trying to be in New Jersey. So I went to talk with her, and she hired me. And I ended up being one of the original staff people with three other people.
Women in Apprenticeship
Program. Women in Apprenticeship
Program. Was it Women in Apprenticeship Agency Program? Or?
No, it was the Women in Apprenticeship Project, okay. And it was a project of the state community database.
And so your job there was counseling and job development. What were you doing?
Right. My job was recruitment, counseling, and job development. Our first job was to just get the word out that we were there. So we did a lot of radio, some TV.
Did you go on the radio and talk about it?
I didn't, Mary Gardner.
She didn't.
She wasn't. But, and the phone calls just started pouring in. I'll never forget the first station on the radio. The phone rang off the hook. The
what radio
day.
Show? Do you remember what station
no,
it was?
No, I don't remember.
And so you did.
And we didn't know if 20 people would call. Yeah. Nobody would call. Right. We had no idea. The phone rang off the hook. I think by the first week we had like 100 people signed up.
So you weren't doing training then? You were recruiting them? How was it working?
You were orienting them and trying to give them a sense of what the jobs were like, what kind of skills were needed for the jobs, and what they would be up against in terms of discrimination and hostility. Help them to fill out applications for the electricians union, the plumbers union, because you have to go through that whole process in order to apprenticeship program. Mm-hmm. I had to sleep online for a week to get just to even hand in our applications for the electricians. So there was a lot of prep work that had to be done for them. We talked to probably between hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands of women.
You had a screening process when they came in that was that, well, everything was very defined in terms of age and qualifications, and so that was one part of the process of screening people out. But what were some of the other things that were part of the process of doing the screening?
Okay, we looked for I think an understanding that this was going to be tough, that they had to be willing to really stick this out, and they had to really want to do this kind of work. Any experience they had at all with tools, with exposure to any kind of construction work, anything that is they've done in their own home, built the cabinet in their house, any kind of sort of informal type work, we really looked at very closely. One woman had done painting, she was an artist, and we got her a job painting boats in the boatyard. They wanted someone who could paint. So she ended up doing that for a long time.
That's significantly better money.
That's significantly better money. Put her actually from the medical school. So that kind of thing, informal skills as well as formal. But very few of women had any kind of training. We also did refer women to a few training programs that there were. There were some adult education programs at the Board of Ed Day. We just filed women into those just to get some kind of experience with school. And there were several CEDA training programs at that time. And we got our hands on the lists of what was there. We just sent women out. We did send a lot of women to training. At least half of the women I referred to were to.
What about the City Technical College? Did that exist then? There was.
Yes. Later on, it did. A little later it did. And there was a program for women in building maintenance. And we referred quite a number of women to that program. And it seemed we did refer some women to the technical. For the 2-year degree. But most women were more interested in just getting into the apprenticeship program and getting a job. They really wanted to work and get paid like they were.
So what were some of the other ways that you recruited them? You went on the radio, flyers,
Women program, women who are receiving welfare. We're notified of our program, so we received a lot of women from, I believe it was from here. We went out and spoke to different women's groups. we went anywhere where we were requested to go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and spoke everywhere.
And so you were doing the counseling also at that time?
Right. Women would come in and we'd have an interview process. They'd have to fill out lots of paperwork. And we would just talk to them and let them talk to them. First they would go through an orientation, maybe 45-minute orientation, where we explain the history of women in the trades, you know, gave them a sense of where they were coming from, that they're not the first women to do this. This is a long history of women doing non-traditional work.
Mm-hmm.
Explained about World War II, how women were, what they did in World War II. You know, we had a sense of history.
Mm-hmm.
Then the reality of what they would have to go through now. And we tried to really just present the picture back, you know, as real as we could,
mm-hmm.
So that we wouldn't get people getting discouraged and dropping out.
Was Mary Garvin trying to connect with the unions at that point and the city and state agencies?
Oh, yes. Definitely. Yeah, mm-hmm. She was meeting with all, and I think I met with some of the union people too. We had state Jim McNamara,
mm-hmm.
Help us out. We met with everybody who would meet with us,
mm-hmm.
all the apprenticeship programs, and we sent letters to, had meetings with, any full kind of connections we had in the years to get along.
And what about companies like Port Authority or Con Edison or telephone companies?
Right.
Were any of them being forthcoming, or was that still like telephone?
It was really difficult. Remember, I met with Con Ed in 1882, and I was really at that point. We met with all the big
mm-hmm.
employers who might have federal contracts. We were especially focusing on people with federal or state contracts
mm-hmm.
because they were more likely to be responsive to us.
Mm-hmm.
And usually you really have to follow up for maybe a year before you even got a promise of a job. And they would give you like one or two jobs here and there.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, okay, now we've got our token woman and our father was in there.
Mm-hmm.
And that it wasn't that difficult to get the first few jobs, but to get a steady stream of jobs after that was very difficult
mm-hmm.
once they got their token woman.
Mm-hmm. So then you started thinking about forming a group, a support group.
Yeah, we had some success, you know, early on in getting women into apprenticeship programs and on jobs, and it just seemed very clear that the women needed more support than we could give them. We were just strung out, you know, just trying to get them the jobs and get them prepared. So what I started doing is I realized we needed a grassroots group. I wanted to somehow get a group together of women who would run their own group. And not be part of a bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm.
So I started identifying women who might be interested and just calling meetings,
mm-hmm.
you know, at night after work. And
now when you talked, in the first interview, you talked about identifying women as leaders. What kinds of things were you looking for in these women? What kinds of characteristics did you see in them? Somebody who could carry the ball.
One, that they had a strong interest in seeing and helping other women in trades themselves and other women. Two, that they had some either some previous experience, you know, or some larger, they could see a larger picture of what was going on. And just that they were, you know, very sharp. Initially, what we did was the women who were coming in,
mm-hmm.
I just started inviting them to meetings. Everybody
mm-hmm.
was invited. And it was a self-selecting group in the beginning. I just thought, whoever comes,
mm-hmm.
comes. And we, out of the first few groups, we didn't, a leadership did not gel. That was
mm-hmm.
maybe the first 8 years. I don't know how many there were.
Mm-hmm.
There were women who were interested, but they weren't really ready to take leadership.
Mm-hmm.
And slowly, one woman would come in, but Cynthia Long came in, Green started coming in, Evan was a little bit older, I think. Chris Gibson. Slowly, the group came together, and it almost seemed to happen like magic. I mean, I remember, it seems like magic now, but I remember that we had all these meetings struggling to get the group together in the beginning. It wasn't so easy. But once we had a core of kind of like five or six people, it just kind of took off, because everyone had great ideas, people had skills, they had a vision for where they wanted trade them to go. It wasn't just, you know, I want to keep my job. It was really a larger, you know, caring about women as a whole.
So what were some of the, it seems that looking through the papers of the United Tradesmen, that you kept expanding what the kinds of things that you were doing. You started this connecting with other organizations and doing advocacy work, like writing letters on behalf of women, following through on particular problems like the carpenters, women in the carpenters, and trying to follow through to make them, you know, here to some commitments. So how did that happen, that you just kept on taking more as you ran into a problem and started to find somebody to try to, what was the process? The whole thing, like, with, for example, one example would be the demonstrations. I mean, you got to a point where you felt strong enough and together enough, and you had a specific target, the convention center, that you felt that you could actually demonstrate. So how did that happen?
Yeah, I think initially we came together to give each other emotional support and the information that we needed to survive our job. Then we started, as problems started coming up, sexual harassment, problems with the union, dealing with the union. Yeah, we started identifying issue areas that were critical for women. That's really what happened. And we started first just doing workshops addressing a particular issue. So it was more workshop work. I was in a unique position because I was working for WAP. I was doing the job development. I was very intimately involved in opening those jobs up at the same time that I knew all the women personally. So I was in a unique position to sort of see a larger picture and understand what the key issues were. Like when the convention center came up and there was, you know, one woman hired out of, I forgot how many thousand jobs, that was like just a natural thing that we would do something about that. Because it was one of our only chances to really get a lot of women. So, and at that point, we did have a good core. Actually, the convention center was about, we had gotten, I think, 3 women on the job. 2 were fired within a few weeks. And we thought unfairly fired. So we fought to get their jobs back. That's actually what that was. They were coming to our meetings. We said, okay, we're going to fight for you to get the jobs back. And we did, and they were both reinstated because of that demonstration. That was, I believe, the first demonstration of women in the country, although there might have been one in Washington before that. I'm not sure, though. I think it might have been the first one. So we, you know, as we saw issues, we would just decide what we wanted to do about that. We were very action-oriented. So we were doing educational work, you know, in terms of the workshop, and also we wanted to do action. We, one woman was being harassed on the job very badly. There were, you know, racist things being said about her, and, you know, seeing pictures being put up on the walls. And she was extremely upset about this. And so we said, well, what can we do? And we went over to the site, a bunch of us, and said, look, we're gonna keep this stuff over. We're gonna do something here big if you guys don't get rid of this. And the next day, and all it took was a visit from a group of women to inform them. Said, look, you know, something's going to happen here if you don't get this stuff out. So we were trying as much as possible to be action. Because it was really necessary. You know, it's one thing to, we needed emotional support, we needed information, we with action. Mm-hmm. Because at that point, there was no, WAF was really kind of a bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. And their hands were tied partly by being state funded. Whereas the United Trades Women was totally grassroots funded. We had no strings attached to anything we did. And we were there to, we were very free to do a lot of things. So that's what we did. I'm trying to think of another action that we did. We wrote letters on behalf of women. We had a second demonstration, actually, which New also participated in, at the Trump Tower, to get women jobs there, the Pots and Pans demonstration.
Oh, yeah. And was that successful?
Moderately so. Mm-hmm. Moderately so. It wasn't, there were a few more women hired. It wasn't overwhelmingly successful. Mm-hmm. It got more and more difficult to get women jobs. It really did. After the initial first, first couple of years. Mm-hmm. And then that's when New Ethics started. I left the organization on New, but they started focusing on training. And United Trades Women. Actually, after a while, United Trades Women, we were trying to figure out what do we want to do? What do we want to become? Mm-hmm. And as, again, I remember at the meeting, we had, we talked about it, but some of the problems were so intense.
Finding direction.
Right.
And also the problems of...
And the intensity of these problems. Yeah. I mean, the problems were so large because of the mafia connections. Mm-hmm. People were frightened. And we couldn't decide what we could be. Some of us were trying to be a democracy organization, a support group, an action group. I mean, there were so many issues to deal with that we really kind of lost our way for a while. We weren't sure what we, what we should do next to really be effective. So, and I think it was at that point we were really struggling to identify what we needed to do next, that some people came into the organization who were very disruptive for whatever reason, probably just their own personal statements. I don't even remember if there were really specific issues around that, like, you know, that you could really discuss issues. Mm-hmm. It was, to me, it just seemed more like disruption for disruption's sake, or just because it was a bad pattern. And what happened is the organization got bogged down in this disruptive addressing basically two individuals and trying to accommodate, trying to understand what was going on. And we really struggled. And some of us were, I mean, we really didn't know how to handle it because we had never really had serious dissent in the group. You know, we might have different ideas, and we would throw ideas around and not be sure what we were doing, but there were no personal attacks. That was one thing. It was a very, very nice group in the sense that people were supportive of one another, respectful of one another. And somehow that changed. I don't know whether it was under the stress that everyone was under, our own lack of understanding of leadership and how to support leadership. Also, we did not have a staff person. I was functioning basically as a de facto staff person, and later on at uni. And we really could not continue that. We needed someone to be there to do our work, you know, to do a lot of that groundwork, and for us to give direction.
Now, was that ever clearly spelled out that, you know, the group was at a crossroads and you really have to make a decision in terms of how it was going to grow and change? Were there?
Yes. Mm-hmm. As I remember, yes. And we had actually decided that, I can't even remember the exact sequence. I know there was this period of great disruption where we actually had meetings just to deal with this disruption. And they were agonizing meetings. Because it was not even really clear. It wasn't like there was even an issue on the table. It's like, one of the issues was we put out a flyer. We used to do fundraising parties. And one of the women had done a flyer. And these other two women felt that the flyer was sexist because it had a woman with naked legs on or something. I mean, it was this kind of thing, not about substantive issues, but about, I don't even know what about. I feel like, you know, now I look back on it, it was just a lot of dysfunctionality, people projecting their own fear of leadership maybe onto us, us being under stress, not having a clear vision, unsure where to go next. And being really exhausted from that struggle, I can't emphasize enough how disruptive that was emotionally. Leadership, you know, I was personally attacked, not for issues. You know,
I know that it was pretty intense for people because years later, when I was talking to people about that, and we were organizing a reunion conference, people still spoke about it with so much emotion.
Apparently, I read a book a few years ago called Between Women. And it described how this was apparently happening all across the country in a lot of different women's groups. As the group sort of was getting more successful and, you know, accomplishing things, and certain people, I always tried to keep a lower profile, but I was a definite leader and had been for a long time. And what happened was leadership was apparently being attacked in many places around the country, and these women speculated that women were fearful of other women's power, and there was like a self-limiting type of thing. I know we were concerned about, you know, consensus and being together and being one,
but competition, kind of.
But there was competition, maybe jealousy or envy about women. I know I felt it myself sometimes towards women, say, who would become very vocal and really be able to speak, become spokespeople. And I think what happened is, like, you would say, oh, she's, you know, becoming more powerful than the rest of us, you know, she's not one of us anymore or something. Instead of respecting that and saying, wow, here's a woman who's strong, who can speak, who can help advance our movement, we were threatened by that on some level. And I think torn between not having a clear understanding of leadership, and that it's okay for women to take leadership, to be powerful, to speak strongly, to be challenged for issues, not for personal, you know, not being attacked personally. I think that was what drew the line for me. It was, you know, I can have someone disagree with me, say, I don't like where you're taking this organization, you know, we think it should go this way. When the attack degenerated into a personal attack, I think that's what really hurt. You know, you can deal with dissent. It's hard, but you can deal with dissent. Dealing with personal attacks is a lot harder. I think that's what...
And questioning your motives, when you feel like your motives are very...
very,
you know,
pure,
very
and
good and pure.
Right, there's a lot of
humble
integrity.
And
when people question your integrity, for me, that was just a real difficult thing. And what happened was we did pull ourselves together after the disruption. That kind of, the two women who were disruptive kind of left. And we did keep going with the group, actually. And we wrote a proposal to get money for a staff person. We decided we needed that. There was also, you know, this issue about being afraid that the staff person would take over. You know, again, this fear of power, fear of women's power, which, you know, I don't completely, now I don't feel anything like that, but back then, I, you know, it was very strong. We all stay at the same level, you know. No one should rise above a certain level. So that was a big fear about getting a staff person. I feel like if we had gotten a staff person a little earlier,
and dealt with those fears directly and said, look, let's just try it out. Let's see. Let's see what happens. We never got there because I know I burned out. I was carrying the ball a lot. Irene was carrying the ball, and we just burned out. And there was no one to pick up the ball at that point. I think people felt very discouraged, which was very sad, because if someone at that point had picked up the ball and said, okay, guys, here's our proposal. Let's go get a staff person and let's run with this. There was no one left to run. It had that disruptive period chased so many people away.
Yeah. Because you were having a very large impact in terms of, you know, programs attracting lots of people and really reaching.
We had hundreds of women at different times, and you know, different women would come and go, and but when the core group, which had been so close, and when that started to fall apart, and I think people also had individual problems that they were dealing with. You know, there was a lot of stress, a lot of stress for women. So I think, you know, a lot of us didn't quite know how to handle all that, and how to make the organization work for us at that period. You know, maybe if we'd had a counselor come in or somebody who was an organizational specialist and could say, oh, you know, yeah, this is happening everywhere, let me tell you. But we didn't have that, which was very unfortunate, because it was really an incredible group. And it never quite came together again after that.
What about allies in terms of the women's movement? Did you reach out to Now New York City or CLUE, Coalition of Labor Women, or what kind of support did you get? Considering that these are the pioneers that you're representing in this group, that you represent the frontiers.
Let's see. We reached out to Now. I remember that was one of our major groups. They had a Women in Non-Traditional Group meeting. Women in the Trades was still meeting for a while. They were more of an entrepreneurial group. CLUE, we met with CLUE. We went to several of their meetings. Women for Racial and Economic Equality. We had a pretty good relationship with them. So those were the major groups. I'm sure there were more, because I know we had a big list of organizations that we had that were on our mailing list.
Was there any effort to get people together to brainstorm about, now we've got so many women and we've got these, quotas or, you know, the 6.9, the federal guideline, they're falling far short of this, any kind of way to talk about how to advance it or move it or support the women who were there, given that? Was any of that going on?
There was a citywide group, the Committee for Women in Non-Traditional Jobs, I think it was called, and it was there were some city representatives there from the Bureau of Labor. I think Now was there, we were there. But it never really went very far, and nothing really very strong came out of it. I remember we did some work around cable TV. That was really more of a city-organized thing. To kind of bring women leaders together and talk about it. And I know we did some work around women in cable TV. But that's about all I remember coming out of that. I talked at some hearings. I spoke at hearings. That's about it. We got more support from the men's groups, the Jim Houghton's group, Uptown Fight Back. He was very helpful to us. He gave us information. He supported us at our demonstrations. He was actually probably one of the most helpful person in his group in terms of giving us concrete support.
And you mentioned in your other interview other Puerto Rican, Black and Puerto Rican caucuses, and Jose Rivera.
Also, right. We didn't do that much direct work with him. He did come out, though, and bring some people out to our demonstration also. So we did try very hard to hook up with some of the men's groups that were there.
Experiencing their own problems.
And they were having their own problems, right. And they gave us the idea to shape up, in fact. We used to go, you know, on the sites at 6 o'clock in the morning and shape up. And they told us, you know, if you just expect to go through the nicey-nicey thing, you know, you're not going to get anywhere. Yeah. You got to go shape. So we started that, and that was very successful, actually. And that was a really tip from them.
So what year did it sort of fall apart? Well, when did you leave New?
I left for a year and a half, then I went back and worked at New again under a different leadership, and that was a much better experience there.
You left when, did you work under Mary Ellen Boyd at all?
Yes, I did. I left, actually, under her, partly because she had fired someone who was a very excellent job developer, counselor, a very grassroots person with a good perspective, and she fired her, and I went in and said, I'm leaving also.
Who was that person?
Chris. I just saw her, too, a few weeks ago. I hadn't seen her in 10 years. Yeah. Might come back to you. Chris Pabon. So I left, and then I did go back later under Rosemary Goldford and worked with her. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, wait a minute. Nope, I take that back. Nope. First, I worked under Mary Garvin. Uh-huh. Then I left because of the extreme dysfunctionality of... It was very interesting. I mean, the women's groups were very dysfunctional on a personal level. Mm-hmm. You know, very abusive to us as workers. We were working so hard, and it was really sad. You know, to I think back on that now. Mm-hmm. And then I left under Mary Garvin. I came back under Rosemary Goldford and then Mary Ellen Boyd. And then I left under Mary Ellen.
Now, one of the comments in the first interview was that Mary Ellen Boyd was very connected to people in the state Department of Labor. And
right.
What were her connections? And what was her background, do you know?
No, I never really totally understood her background, but she was extremely well-connected to the state, very well-connected, and she was able to keep the funding coming through her connections. Also, it was a very good program. Yeah, we were doing really good work, but she was particularly, she was good for the program in that she really kept the money flowing. You know, and
they had expanded into training.
She expanded into training, which was good because then it was very specific training for women instead of just throwing us into the other programs. I think it was very good. Right, but the organization again, it changed from became more. We were more bureaucratic and less grassroots, less activist oriented, more into like a social work type of group. Which I didn't feel very comfortable with. Mm-hmm.
So about how many women were working there when you left, or people working there?
I don't know. It was probably like four counselors, maybe, and a supervisor, something like that. Mm-hmm.
So where did you go when you left New? Left New?
When I left New, I decided to go to electronics school.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was the motivation for that?
I had placed a number of women in electronics jobs, and they seemed to really enjoy it. It looked like an interesting, and they were getting paid very well. And I'd always liked math and physics, and I said, let me just try this out. Mm-hmm. So I took an electrical wiring course at night for free at Brooklyn Tech, and I loved it. I did very well at it. Before I went, I said, well, this is something maybe I could do. And then I enrolled in New York City Tech. And
now, what did you love about it? Because it's hard for me to think you're going from working with people and working with concepts like, you know, social policy and economics, and then you have this job where you have this piece of machinery that you're wiring. What is it that grabbed you?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I was totally burnt out.
Working with people.
It was just emotionally draining at that point. I wanted to do something that did not involve taking care
back.
Of people. Right. And so actually it was a very deliberate decision to move away from caretaking type of thing. Which, see, initially I didn't see myself as, I'm not a social worker. I am really an organizer. And when the job moved more and more from organizing to social worky type of thing, it just became less and less suitable for me. And I was too burnt out to keep organizing at that point. So I said, let me go back to school and do something that I can make a little money, too. So I really liked it. I just found that I had an aptitude for it. We started a group at school called Technicians for Social Responsibility. And we talked about, you know, technology and critiques of technology and ways technology is being used that were not so hot. So it was really fun.
So what school were you at?
I was at New York City Technical College.
Okay.
And in fact, one of the women who I had placed on a truck driving job at Pan Am was laid off from Pan Am when they dissolved. And she came to school with me also, and we were building computers instead. And we both really had a nice time together, and she was in that group. So mm-hmm. it was a nice continuing mm-hmm. sort of a connection.
How long did that program take?
For me, it took a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
That was another thing, because I could get in and out pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
What else?
How many women were in the program?
There were four women
out of
like hundreds of guys. My experience in my profession now, there are less women than there are in women in construction.
Now, this is a job where you don't have to be physically strong. You don't have to lift big cement slabs.
Right. I have to lift that monitor, which is about 80 pounds.
UPS, you have to lift 70-pound box. So.
Right, right. So usually it's not a real big part of the job.
Yeah.
It's more being able to troubleshoot, being able to figure things out.
Using your mind.
And just figure out problems.
Yes. So are the schools doing recruiting, as far as you can tell, to getting women, from, you know, vocational high schools, and this is not happening?
As far as I'm aware, there is no, except at New York City Tech, they did have the program, women's outreach program, but they mostly channeled women into building maintenance, the special program they had, which was okay because it was good for a lot of women who maybe couldn't have gotten through a two-year, you know, engineering program.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it was pretty successful.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of women in engineering, there's still 4% women, approximately 4% women in engineering and in technician. I'm a technician, mm-hmm. I'm an engineer. Just very, very few women.
Last night on the news, it wasn't the news, it was the History Channel, and they were doing a program on the sand hogs.
Oh,
and
yeah,
then they switched to the water tunnel.
Oh, yeah?
And they had a woman engineer, female engineer, describing the water tunnel project. So that was quite nice to see.
Good. Yeah.
Different.
It's unusual, right?
Yeah. And she had her hard hat and her degree and mm-hmm. was speaking with great authority about all this technical things.
Great. Good to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's still a long way to go. Be nice if there was a woman in technical program. One of the things we always had in the United Trades program was it was heavily geared towards construction.
Mm-hmm.
And there were several women technicians involved, but it wasn't a real strong, mm-hmm. the construction mm-hmm. needs took over very strongly.
Right. Well, it seems to me that this is an area that, that women could actually make a difference in terms of doing some kind of just even educational, like speaking or watching what these programs are doing in terms of recruitment and outreach.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, in my job, I was able to help, get two women hired, which is like phenomenal. And there's three women on the job, which is almost unheard of. Most departments in the city have no women. And that was my own really pushing very
mm-hmm.
hard for
yeah.
that.
Mm-hmm.
And, I feel good about that. I was able to do that mm-hmm. and give them a lot of support on the job. Support each other. It's really
mm-hmm.
nice.
So, so then your first job, when you graduated, what did you do?
I got a job even before I graduated, part-time, as a biomedical tech. It's interesting, my co-worker now was the person I heard speak at New York City Tech about biomedical engineering.
Who's that?
Nick, we met.
Okay.
And he was so eloquent, really, and as soon as I heard him speak, I knew that was what I wanted to do immediately.
And how did he cast the job, the field? What interested you?
He cast it as a very responsible job for someone who cared about people, you know, so it's sort of related to people. The work you were doing is directly related to saving people's lives. It required a lot of sense of responsibility because the job that you did could really hurt. I mean, you could hurt someone if you didn't do a good job on the equipment. So I guess that's what I like.
So how did he come to speak at your school?
And it wasn't military. So
what program was he part of that he got to speak there?
I don't know, actually. I'll have to ask him. Yeah. He just kind of showed up at this like career day one day, and I listened to him and said, "That's it. That's where I'm going."
I know New York Technical College used to have a career day every year.
Right.
And I don't know exactly what it involved, but...
Right. That's what this was just a departmental career day. Yeah. It was a departmental thing. And he had graduated from there, so he said they called him back as someone. If you're going to be in electronics, it's a great place to be because it is a very human, you know, you're very aware of the human consequences of what you do.
A lot of responsibility.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So your first job that into this field, where did you work?
Jersey City and Hoboken. I worked at two different hospitals at the same time. And I learned a lot because there were just two of us on the job, and I had to learn everything fast. So I learned a tremendous amount about, and also on my job I have to know a lot about physiology and clinical practice and how the equipment is used, you know, in surgery. I have to know not just the equipment, but the whole procedure and how, what's going on. So it's very interesting. I get to know a lot.
Now, do you take courses, like, do you have in-service or continuing education courses that you were able to before and you can take? And
yes, in fact, I organized most of them. We just did a video course. We did a course on pacemakers, external pacemakers. Where they're able to, instead of implanting wires in the body, they can, pace someone from the surface of the body. And that's a very different kind of technology. So we have to learn about that. So as new technologies develop, laser technology now is increasing in use, and I have to learn about lasers. Which I've been doing. I'm in charge of the whole laser program. So things, things move along.
So it's always
kind of interesting. Yeah. It's not always interesting, but it's often interesting.
Okay. Now you have a strong interest in education, teaching. You've been doing some teaching.
Right. I taught at New York City Tech. I was an assistant teacher there for the electronics lab. And my favorite thing was I taught a pre-engineering course in Metro North Brookers. Mm-hmm. And we had a great time learning about what engineering is, sort of critiques of engineering, what are the different aspects of engineering, safety issues, ethical issues, math, computers.
Now, why was Metro North running this?
They want to upgrade their staff, have their people become more technically proficient, and they're trying to encourage people to go to engineering school.
As the technology changes?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Their technology is changing very rapidly, and people are going to be out of work if they don't update their skills. Mm-hmm. So this was to get people ready to go to school so they could update their skills.
So you had to not only explain the technology, but you had to make them see that it was something that was accessible for them, that they weren't frightened by it.
Right.
Is that a component of that class? What did you like about it?
Yeah, in terms of giving people a sense of how broad engineering is and changes that were happening, and giving them a sense of self-esteem, too, that they could go back to school. Mm-hmm. They would be able to survive school and learn and move on. And I think people came out of that with a great sense of self-esteem. That they could do it.
Have you taught any courses at New?
No, I haven't. I've seriously considered that. In fact, I was thinking recently of calling Martha over there, and because it would be really a lot of fun to teach electronics to women.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of jobs out there in the papers for technicians.
Yeah.
So, think I will do that.
It seems the New York City Board of Ed back in 1989-90 had a program where they were trying to get women who did non-traditional jobs to go into the high schools and speak to young girls. And I don't know what became of that. But it seems that's when I was at AED, so that's how I know about it. And it seems to me a great idea, but I don't know if they've continued that.
I don't know, but maybe I should call New York City Tech or something and volunteer to be on one of their career days or something, you know?
Yeah. What are the obstacles for you in terms of this job? Is there a glass ceiling or... you're a supervisor, aren't you? Have you been a supervisor for around 3 years?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, about three... almost 4 years.
Mm-hmm. And how did that take place?
We were actually building two new hospitals, and we were going to get completely new equipment, brand new equipment for the entire hospitals, both hospitals. And they needed someone to supervise that whole process and make sure the installations went well and the equipment was checked out properly and installed. We hired seven new people to do that, and we needed someone to run the team.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a logical person because I know the equipment really well, and I'm able to work well with the staff. So,
now I just want to ask you a question, which probably sounds like out of the ballpark, but did you have any sort of fears or feelings that you felt confident that you could do it?
Yes, that job, I feel very confident on this job.
Mm-hmm.
I really do. That was not always the case. I think it took me about 5 years to feel... I used to be afraid sometimes if I got a new piece of equipment in, and I didn't know it. I was like, oh my gosh, how am I going to know how to repair this?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm just like, give me anything. You know, after about 5 years, I felt very, very confident. And I just feel like I can... pretty much do anything. It's sort of like learning music, once you learn the music and you've kind of gotten over the hurdle of being able to read music, and you can people can give you almost anything and you can play. Yeah. You might fumble along for a while, but like that.
I have a brother-in-law who's a mechanic, and I watch the way that he looks at a problem, any machine, he's also, give him anything and he'll fix it. And he just sort of, works through these problems and lays things out, and I feel like, it is similar to music. It's like a brilliant musician who can just play any score.
Right.
But it's wonderful to watch who's so calm and thought.
Right. That's how you have to
So, what about glass ceiling, or is this not a problem?
No, in this field, actually, it is a problem. At least in the field is changing. It's because medical care is changing in whole, as you know, the whole healthcare reimbursement system. This is a very new field. It's only about 20 years old. And I got into it, 10 years ago. So it was a very new field. And what happened was you got large departments in big hospitals, 15 people maybe at a hospital this size. What's happening now with the downsizing and everything is they're outsourcing a lot of this work, just like in regular, and what's happening is a lot of, not so much here in the city, but in other places, especially in small hospitals, they're closing down biomedical departments and outsourcing it to just outside contractors who come in with half the staff, pay them a lot less. They're non-union, of course, and it's a real problem. And there's a lot of fear in this profession about that happening. So in some ways it creates openings because they need new managers and supervisors to go out and do that work, for the contractors. So the jobs now are with the contractors. They're not with the hospitals. So here there's a glass ceiling. No one ever leaves hardly once you get into a management position because there are not that many positions.
Mm-hmm.
So... there is a glass ceiling. It's not so much because I'm a woman, I think. It's just because, it's more because, just just no one leaves. I mean, the people who've been here have been here for like 15 years.
Retired.
And they'll retire here probably most of all, if they don't, if the department doesn't dissolve first.
It seems to me, just watching my sister's work with hospital administration, that they do a lot of outreach in terms of the community. And does this hospital do any kind of PR or any kind of recruitment in terms of the skills that are needed to work here, or they just leave that all to the educational institutions? They don't try to do recruitment in terms of,
or you mean, you know, training? Like, you mean training people here?
Know, information about the fields that are available and trying to do some kind of publicizing, yeah.
As far as I know, they don't. Mm-hmm. I mean, one thing about our department is that, and this whole field, is that you studied in the electronics generally, and then mm-hmm. you actually really are trained on the job, because no one can know what a pacemaker is like. Mm-hmm. I mean, where are you going to work on a pacemaker except in a hospital or a laser? Mm-hmm. You know, so it really is on the job training here in that sense.
You mentioned that the contractors are non-union. Do you have a union here for the people in this field?
No, unfortunately, we don't. Many other hospitals around the city in my field are organized. Mm-hmm. Mount Sinai, Columbia Presbyterian.
Mm-hmm. With 1199?
With 1199. Mm-hmm. This hospital, apparently, and 1199 is very aware of us. They know we're here. I've personally spoken to them, mm-hmm. and no one has come to organize us. And so I think the hospital has some kind of a arrangement mm-hmm. yeah. to keep us non-union.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's another
subject. That's all I can say. It's another subject.
Yeah. So in terms of your personal goals, where do you feel that you're sort of at a plateau, you're happy, but you've reached a plateau, you have some future goals that loom for you, things that you'd like to achieve? When are those?
Yes. In terms of this job, I feel like, you know, there's always new things to learn here. I'm learning a lot more about video now, becoming more of a video expert and laser expert. So there's always new things to learn. The technology, talk about the problem and, you know, discuss what she's doing. It's a typical case of a user. It's not the technology that's bad, it's the way the technology is being used, you know, it's not used properly. So,
so like if you put too much salve on the...
Yeah, or not enough, or, yeah. you're, or you don't have the placement correct, you'll get a very low signal from the person, and it looks like the technology isn't working, but it is. You know, so you need to... So that's how you need to know, you know, so you do work with people in a certain sense with the hospital staff.
And you come across people who are resistant to new technology, sort of have fear of technology?
So. Yeah, that was interesting. That was one of our biggest, when we installed the whole new hospital with all new equipment. You know, nobody knew any of this equipment.
Yeah.
And that was one of our biggest jobs was to help people, to be on hand so people could learn from us, you know, and we would train people and stand by, you know, the first few days, you know, to make sure that they're okay with it. Mm-hmm. So that was good.
So you were saying about your personal goals.
Personal goals. I find it's interesting. On this job, I also do a lot of teaching. I've trained most of the technicians here, and I've written a lot of our procedures for training. I've organized a lot of seminars, technical seminars, and my passion really is teaching. I realize that even on this job, I'm in my glory when I'm teaching, you know. So my goal really is to find a place for me to make a difference in people's lives through teaching technology in some way, or critiques of technology, because I think it's really important for people to understand the limits of technology and the dangers, and to really look at that seriously. So I would like to find a place to do that. I'm not sure where that's going to be yet. It might be in a number of different places part-time. Mm-hmm. you know, working at NU to teach women mm-hmm. so they can get good jobs, working in a high school maybe for Folk Tech High School, working in a place like Metro North. I want to use my skill. I want to move back towards the people realm a little mm-hmm. bit more,
yeah.
you know, and still keep the technology. So I think technology education would be a good way to go. So I'm just starting to look into that now and explore that and see if that's possible.
In terms of your, in terms of organizing, the part mm-hmm. of you that's an organizer, do you have some goals or dreams or things that you're thinking of that you'd like to see happen?
One of my dreams, actually, is to go to third world countries and who have, like, such as in Nicaragua, Brazil, where they have, let me say, very old equipment, and they need someone mm-hmm. to help them use it and repair it, put it back together so it can be used to help people. That's one possibility. In terms of organizing, I've done organizing at home, you know, in my community, in terms of environmental things. I haven't actually done any women's organizing for quite a while around women's issues. And I thought a lot, I've been doing a lot of reading about women in technology and possibly get, I'm not aware that there's a forum except for women, and there's a group called Women in Engineering. I am at a strange place because I'm not an engineer. Most mm-hmm. of the stuff that you see out there, the women's organizations, mm-hmm. are engineering. Mm-hmm. Very different from what I do. I'm not
right.
different, on a different level. Yeah. It's a mm-hmm. different level of salary, it's a different level of mm-hmm. status. In terms of technicians, you know, and the kind of level I'm at, mm-hmm. Except to organize a union here. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm not sure where to go with that. Mm-hmm. I've thought about it a lot, and I haven't seen anything out there so far.
What about the situation with women currently in terms of the attack on affirmative action and the mood of the country in terms of sort of saying that there's no need to commit to this, and there's no political will, basically, amongst the articulate politicians. Mm-hmm. How do you, having watched women from being there when women were getting into the non-traditional fields, what do you have to say about the situation now?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's deplorable. Mm-hmm.
Anything
it's, it seems hard to believe. I mean, I know mm-hmm. it was hard, affirmative action was fought for hard, and it's going to continue to be. I think a lot of people think women have it made now. You know, we've already opened a lot of doors, and it's like, what else is there to do? You know, and again, for women in engineering, for whatever reason, there's only 4% women in engineering and in technical work. It's a very low percentage. And I'm absolutely committed to affirmative action. I haven't personally done any organizing around that issue. I'm not even aware of what groups are doing that.
Well, one of the arguments that I keep reading, the people who are opposed to it, they say that there's already, there's already a commitment to equal, fair hiring and equality in terms of educational institutions and jobs, and so there's no need for this.
Right.
What would you say to that?
Well, I would say, I mean, from personal experience, I went on an interview about a month, 2 months ago, for a biomedical job. It was a position, a supervisory position. It was actually department head, really, but the guy didn't want to pay a person for department head, so he called it a supervisor. And one of his questions to me was, I mean, I am highly, highly qualified. I already do the job here at a much bigger hospital. This is a very small hospital. I supervise 10 people now. This was about 3 people. He said, I'm very concerned about how the men will react to you. You know, I don't think they're going to like having a woman here. He actually said this in the interview. I was surprised he said it. And I was very angry, but I just said, I work with all men now, mostly. I have no problem being respected. So, I mean, just the fact that you could ask that question in 1996 of someone who is beyond doubt highly overqualified even for the job. And to bring up the fact that I'm a woman, I just thought was abominable. So it just shows that this issue is very real. It's very much alive. And it's out there. Mm-hmm. And it's out there on all levels of mm-hmm. society. You know, all levels of society. So it makes me angry.
Okay, well, thank you.